to start off with today, we're going to look back in time at another one of these German war heroes, and this is Mikhail Wittmann. Have I pronounced that correctly?
That's right.
Excellent. Do you want to let the listeners know what's so special about this fine German man?
Yes, extraordinary man, in my opinion. He was nicknamed the Black Baron by some, which is an allusion to Manfred von Richthofen, the World War I German pilot, also known as the Red Baron. But he was not from a noble family. He was a farmer's son, actually. He was born in 1914 in Vogeltal, Bavaria, born to Johann Wittmann, and was baptized a Roman Catholic. He grew up on the farm, and after completing his obligatory schooling in 1930, at the age of 16, he went on to work on the farm of his father full-time. He was introduced to game hunting, which he was reluctant to embrace because of his deep love for animals and nature in general. These were, however, very hard times for most Germans, and to hunt or not to hunt might be the difference between staying hungry or not. So he did take to hunting. And then in early 1934, Wittmann decided to join the FAD, Freiwilliger Arbeitsdienst, or Voluntary Labor Service, which would later become the Reichsarbeitsdienst, or Reich Labor Service, which I mentioned when we talked about Erich Hartmann. Wittmann enjoyed his time there tremendously, especially because of the emphasis on cooperation and camaraderie. In late 34, he then decided to join the German military, which at the time was still a very small force without heavy artillery, tanks, a navy to speak of, or an air force. He was assigned to the 19th Infantry Regiment, and he signed up for 2 years of service. Military life was completely new to him, but he soon adapted well to the drills, and again, he enjoyed the cooperation, the cohesion, and the camaraderie he experienced. And it was there that he saw, for the first time in his life, a Panzer, or tank, a Panzerkampfwagen 1, which is a very light tank, thinly armored, with only 2 machine guns mounted in a turret. But he was immediately fascinated by these machines. And after 2 years of service, where he left the army to briefly work in railway construction, and he had, however, already decided that he wanted to join the Allgemeine SS. He applied, that's the General SS, not the Waffen SS. The Allgemeine SS had more to do with administration. He applied to be accepted and was without any problems. He was soon bored, however, with the administrative tasks, the paper pushing he was assigned to. So he decided to join the SS Verfügungstruppen, which would later turn into the Waffen SS, which is armed SS or weapon SS, literally. This was by no means easy, as only a small percentage of applicants were accepted based on physical and mental fitness. But Wittmann succeeded and in 1937 became a member of the Leibstandarte SS Adolf Hitler, Hitler's elite bodyguard unit. And there he was trained as a crewman for armored reconnaissance vehicles, and in 1938 witnessed the reunification of Austria and the Sudetenland with the Reich, and he experienced and saw how grateful and joyful the German troops were received and greeted, which made a great impression on him. And in the meantime, of course, he had seen for himself how life for Germans had gotten so much better since the National Socialists had come to power. And indeed, he did become a dedicated National Socialist, attending the political rallies and later, in fact, joining the party. In 1939, in the Poland campaign, he was to see actual combat for the first time, commanding one of the armored scout cars. He also saw action in the France campaign, and afterwards he was transferred back to the Reich, where he was to learn the command of a Sturmgeschütz, or Stug in short, which is assault gun in English. These were basically tanks without a movable turret, but instead a stronger cannon. So you had to move the whole tank in order to aim for a target. But they were not only cheaper to build than a tank with a turret, they also had a lower profile and were thus harder to see and hit in combat on the battlefield. And after months of training on the new vehicle, Wittmann and the Leibstandarte were again in combat during the Balkans campaign. And once that campaign came to a victorious end on June the 1st of 1941, there was a brief rest for the Leibstandarte. But soon Operation Barbarossa was launched on the 21st of July of the same year, the war with Soviet Russia. And the Leibstandarte did not participate in the first battles, but they were assigned to the Army Group South, which was headed to the Caucasus regions region to secure the oil fields there. On the 21st of July, events occurred that gave an indication as to the true potential of Michael Wittmann as commander of an armored vehicle. If I may, I will just read a description of what happened there.
Please do, yeah.
On the 12th of July, Wittmann's Stuk 3 was ordered to move to a vantage point on a hill designated point 65.5. After reaching their objective, after nearly running into a ditch, Rottenführer Klink, Wittmann's gunner, spotted a number of enemy vehicles rapidly approaching. After moving into a position offering additional visual advantage, 18 T-34 tanks were spotted, one group of 12 and another group of 6. After ordering his driver, Koldenhoff, to reposition the vehicle on the left side of the hill, Wittmann prepared his crew for the onslaught, and the gun was set to take the Russian armor head-on. After repositioning again in order to gain a view over the hill, the first of the T-34 was quickly taken out, with one round of armor-piercing shot from the 75mm cannon. As the Stuk 3 was not equipped with a rotating turret, all of the responsibility would be placed on the driver Koldenhoff, who with consummate skill quickly rolled the vehicle into a suitable vantage point, allowing Klink to obtain an accurate bead on a second T-34, which was quickly engulfed in flames. Within seconds, loader Peterson had slammed the next round into the hot and oily breach. After a close escape from another T-34 and a Russian gunner with very poor aim, Wittmann managed to reach the edge of a small wood in order to plan his next move. While carrying out a quick recce, I think that's recce, is it reconnaissance? Are you familiar yeah. with the shortening?
Yeah, a recce, reconnaissance.
Recce.
Yeah, recce. A recce.
Recce. On foot, Wittmann spotted a third enemy vehicle. Assuming that he had not been spotted, Wittmann was rocked off his feet when a terrific crash sounded around him. After dusting himself off, he found himself looking at the destroyed T-34, its turret completely blown off and now sticking out of the ground like a flagpole. Klink's power of observation, initiative and gunnery skills had been the obvious factor here, with both vehicles firing simultaneously, the T-34 and the Stuk 3. Wittmann's gunner had been alert enough to locate, sight, and hit the target. On returning, Wittmann was the first to praise his skillful gunner. And after another near miss, following two misplaced shots from an itinerant T-34, Wittmann quickly spotted another Soviet vehicle. Kicking the powerful Maybach engine to life, Koldenhoff skillfully maneuvered the Stuk 3 to allow Klink a crack at the enemy panzer. In a flash, the fourth Russian tank was obliterated. After another close encounter with a rather deceptive water crossing, expertly negotiated by Koldenhoff, Wittmann set out to locate three Russian vehicles he had seen earlier. After scanning the area, he saw the three T-34 sitting with engines running on top of a hill. After Koldenhoff quickly moved the Stuk 3 within 500 meters of the last Soviet panzer, Klink quickly reacting to Wittmann's command, let off a round of 75 millimeter armor piercing shot, which found its way to the Russian vehicle with a resounding crack. The remaining T-34 would quickly redirect their aim towards Whitman's vehicle, and Koldenhoff desperately moved the Stuk 3 into position. Klink let go another round, which bounced off the enemy tank. Loader Peterson was working overtime, and Klink eventually managed to get a shot in, which seemed to have disabled the turret of the enemy machine. While all of this was happening, the third T-34 had decided to head for safety. Their work seemingly done, Whitman and his crew began to head off, only to see the turret of the second T-34 crank back into life. Peterson quickly slammed in another round into the breach, and the resulting shot saw the Russian vehicle burst into flames, its crew desperately trying to escape the inferno. On this day, in addition to the tremendous courage shown by Whitman and his crew in the destruction of six Soviet vehicles, the young Stuk commander was to show a spirit of humanity that was otherwise lacking in this terrible conflict. Seeing three of the Russians in obvious pain, he ordered his crew to smother the flames, engulfing them with their bedrolls. The evening of the 12th of July 1941 was to see SS Unterscharführer Whitman being awarded the first of what would be many decorations, the Iron Cross, second class, which he received from an elated Sepp Dietrich. As a testament to the humanity of this brave soldier, on being asked by Dietrich if he had any special wish, Whitman requested that the three wounded Russians be given the best medical treatment. The newly decorated Stuk 3 commander was warmly received by his loyal crew. A warrior had truly been born. And this narrative was mostly composed from reports or paragraphs written in a book called Michael Whitman and the Panzer Commanders of the Leibstandarte.
Wow. That's a real example to set, isn't it? Incredible skill, taking out six tanks and then going in there to put the flames out and ensure that the people that you have defeated are well looked after once they have been defeated. You contrast that to the way Muslims behave today. In fact, just contrast that to the way that the Allies behaved during the Second World War. And we really were the bad guys in that war. I mean, that's a really positive example to set, and the fact that was made known to the German people, that was a good example, that was the example that we want to be setting. It wasn't sort of covered up as being a bad thing that he had rescued the three Russians. I think that's
yes, and the courage that it takes to get out there. Well, first of all, to take on six Russian T-34s who had a superior cannon compared to his Stuk. They had the turrets that could swivel around and fire in any direction, while he had to move the whole vehicle. And then getting out, basically still mid-battle for reconnaissance purposes. Incredible courage.
It makes me sort of see in my mind's eye the scenes from your documentary, Dennis, with the tank battles in it. And, you know, just the feeling of excitement in that. And imagining that sort of thing going on, that bravery and the courage that was involved, and these people that were fighting for what they knew to be right. And he'd seen how good National Socialism was. I mean, he'd lived through from the First World War through the Weimar period to the National Socialist period, and seen just how positive everything was, and how good everything was. I think you managed to capture that really well, Dennis, the tank fighting in that, because that's what I was seeing as I was hearing Schmidt read that. Yeah. was the bits from your film.
Whitman, compared to the two that we spoke about since, I had heard of but didn't know a lot about him. But from what I can gather from what I just heard then, like the fact that he went to help his victims, so to speak, was something that I don't think the Bolsheviks would ever do. As you mentioned, like, you know, many people, you know, ISIS and people like that wouldn't do that now. So very, very Christian attitude, I felt, in doing that, and good to see a real hero.
That's humanity, isn't it? That's what humane beings do. That's where the word human being, humane being, comes from. And, you know, some people might not like to hear this, but it is only white people that ever do anything like that. It's only white people that behave in humane ways to their enemy. You know, that's the mark of the white man, is that he behaves honorably to his enemy. You just don't get that in the other races. Well, the Bolsheviks were, a lot of them were Mongoloids, weren't they?
Yeah.
Mongoloids and Jews and Turks. They were oppressing the Russians just as much as they were attacking against the Germans. Well, do you think we should continue on with that rather than going on to next week? Do you think you can, how much more have we got of Mikhail Wittmann there, Schmidt?
Oh, this, of course, depends completely on you, but it seems that I still have a lot of material. So if maybe we should do another part next week, then, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, I think we really should do him justice and not rush to get through it, because we've got a couple of other subjects that we want to cover this week. So we'll do a second part on Mikhail Wittmann next week, I think. Especially if you, because you've done a lot of research into this as well, haven't you?
Yeah, maybe I can mention for people who are interested that they can listen to Mikhail Wittmann's voice if they enter into YouTube. Mikhail Wittmann interview, June 1944. They will actually hear a radio interview with him that was aired on German radio, where he talks about his experiences in France, especially at the Villers-Bocage battle. And they can find a lot of pictures on the internet of Mikhail Wittmann, and there's the occasional documentary. Like, there's one to be found on YouTube called Tanks! !03 The Aces, Mikhail Wittmann, if people want to have additional information.
And one thing I noticed when looking him up today, looking at the picture, it really struck me as looking very similar to Andrew Anglin. Sort of a cross between Andrew Anglin and Tommy Robinson. Quite bizarre. I was looking at it, I was thinking, who does that remind me of? I'm sure people will see that for themselves if they look him up.
Maybe I could remind the listeners of where we left off. That was that story that we heard where Mikhail Wittmann took out 6 enemy tanks, T-34s, with his Stuk 3 tank, if people remember that. And then I would continue. So the following month after these events, Mikhail Wittmann was wounded for the first time by shell fragments when his Stuk was hit, and this earned him the wounded badge in black. And in the meantime, he had taken out several more T-34 tanks and anti-tank guns. And this is all at the Eastern Front. And Wittmann would actually consider it more of a coup to take out an anti-tank gun because of their small size. They are more difficult to spot. They are more easily concealed by the enemy. And they can still do considerable damage to a tank, especially if it hits from the side or the tracks especially. And then in October, he was wounded again and promoted to SS Oberscharführer, which translates to senior squad leader, while at the same time being recommended for officer training. On the 21st of November, he was awarded the Panzerkampfabzeichen, or Tank Assault Badge, in silver, for having taken part in 25 heavy engagements with enemy forces. And by this time, the heavy Russian winter had set in and had made life at the front very miserable, aside from the usual horrors of war. And the German advance came to halt in most places at the Eastern Front. But they were able to dig in and resist counterattacks for the most part. Wittmann was then recalled to Germany to attend the Waffen-SS Junkerschule, or officer school, in Bad Tölz in Bavaria, And if you remember, he was born there in Bavaria. The physical and mental training and testing there was probably the most severe of any military school. In addition to physical exercise and training on different weapons, they also had to take courses in etiquette, so they would be impeccable in any social situation, or be a perfect gentleman, in other words. The training routines placed great emphasis on camaraderie and cooperation. And as we've heard last time, that was something Michael Wittmann put great emphasis on, or enjoyed a lot, the teamwork. A team leader would feel responsible for the team he was commanding, but at the same time feel as part of the team. That is how the SS worked. The officers were undergoing the same hard physical training and mental training, and they would not feel above their men. They would be their superiors in the command structure, but they would consider themselves a vital part of the team, and they would also go into combat with their team. And this is probably one of the reasons why so many SS officers, up to the highest grades, fell alongside their subordinates in battle at the front line. They would not just send them into battle, but go into battle with them. And for some further reading, I would recommend everything General Leon de Grel wrote about the war at the Eastern Front. He was also an SS man. And he made it from the lowest rank, basically, to the highest rank by achievements on the battlefield. He was actually offered to get an officer's promotion from the start, but he refused. But I'm digressing. So back to Wittmann. His training concluded on the 5th of September of 1942, and he was now a Fähnrich, an officer candidate. He was assigned to the SS Panzer Replacement Battalion in Weimar, where he changed back into the familiar black Panzer uniform. He had worn it already while commanding the armored scout cars, but while he was commanding the Stuk III, the assault gun, which were considered part of a different weapon category, he accordingly wore the field gray uniform of the SS. And on the 21st of December, he was posted at the Heavy Panzer Replacement and Training Battalion 500 at Paderborn with the commissioned rank of SS Untersturmführer, which is equivalent to second lieutenant. And from there, he was transferred to northern France to begin training on the tank he had only heard rumors about. And this was the Panzerkampfwagen 6, which is better known as the Tiger tank. The Leibstandarte returned to the Eastern Front in January of 1943 as part of the newly created SS Panzer Corps. At first, however, Wittmann was given command not of a Tiger, but a, by this time, rather dated Panzer III, probably because of his experience with the armored scout cars. These Panzer IIIs were used like a shield to provide cover for the Tigers, as they were faster than the Tigers, and thus able to prevent outflanking of the main force. But then, after several weeks following the arrival of 5 new Tigers at the front, he was finally given his own to command. By this stage of the war, the Germans and their allies were virtually always outnumbered in terms of tanks, airplanes, and infantrymen, sometimes by as much as 1-10. The Leibstandarte was often used as a firefighter unit in the sense that they would be sent to collapsing parts of the front to throw back the advancing Soviet armies. In July 1943, the Battle of Kursk took place. It was the largest tank battle in history, with the Germans fielding nearly 3,000 tanks and the Soviets having over 5,000 at this particular place, the area around Kursk. The Soviets also outnumbered them in any other category, having almost 2 million infantry, while the Germans had about 700,000 available. And it was a desperate attempt by the German side to bring together as much force as they possibly could by combining the army groups center and south. But even so, they could only field a fraction of what the Soviets could. And keep in mind, this was not just the Soviet industrial capacity. War material worth over $100 billion in today's money was delivered to the Soviets by the United States during the war. And Germany could simply not keep up with that. For another comparison, the Germans had less than 10,000 artillery and mortar pieces, while the Soviets had over 25,000 at Kursk. At Kursk, however, Wittmann destroyed 30 enemy tanks and 28 anti-tank guns. For a time, he was acting company commander because the commander had been wounded and shortly after his stand-in as well. All this was, however, not enough to earn him the Knight's Cross, which gives an indication of just how much you had to achieve to receive it. To give an impression on how the Leibstandarte and the other units performed at the tank battle of Prokhorovka, which was part of the larger Battle of Kursk. At this particular battle, the German side lost 850 men and a total of just 5 panzers, while the Soviets suffered 5,500 killed or wounded and losing 300 tanks. It was not enough, however. From that time onwards, the German soldiers would be almost always on the defensive. So the Battle of Kursk was not decisive in the sense that one side prevailed over the other, but it was the losses were so horrible, even though less compared on the German side, but they just couldn't keep up with the production of tanks, aircraft, and other war material. On the 17th of July, Wittmann and his comrades of the Panzer Corps were redeployed to Italy, but there was little they could do there as the Italians surrendered to the Allies in September of the same year. Wittmann was actually considered to be somewhat of a lone wolf on the battlefield. That was not so when he was with his comrades. He was very well liked, and people describe him as a humble man, a man very easy to like. But on the battlefield, he would often go out alone, as we heard in that first story of how he took out the six Soviet tanks. On the 14th of January 1944, Wittmann was finally awarded the Knight's Cross after having destroyed 88 tanks and countless other vehicles and military equipment. Then, after destroying his 100th tank, Adolf Hitler himself sent him a telegram informing him of having earned the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross and inviting him to Berlin, where he would receive the decoration from his hands. And what was also unusual was that his gunner, Wittmann's gunner, Balthasar Woll, was also to receive the Knight's Cross. So there, in this one tank, there were two Knight's Cross holders. Whenever he could, he would take Woll with him as his gunner, because he had proven himself again and again, and often firing actually without Wittmann's command, with Wittmann approving of this, of course, because in the heat of battle, it's not always possible to have the complete situational awareness and being able to give the precise order at the exact time it is needed. And then again, he went back to the Eastern Front. He was sent back, among other things, to help free the German soldiers surrounded and trapped in the Cherkasy pocket, where actually General Leon Degrelle was fighting at the time. But then he was to leave the Eastern Front for good. In the spring of 1944, he was sent back home to Germany, where he married his fiancée Hildegard, which he had gotten to know in one of his earlier training exercises in Germany. And his gunner Woll, Balthasar Woll, was his best man at the wedding. they had to celebrate their honeymoon in Belgium, where Whitman was sent next. And then in France, where the Allies had landed and had made progress towards the inland, there was the Battle of Villers-Bocage. And what happened there was that the Whitman had actually only three serviceable Tigers at his command. And the Allies had taken Villers-Bocage, and they were moving to a strategically important hill. And the Germans were not aware of this, however. And Whitman, going on a scout mission with his with a single Tiger, saw a an entire British tank column on the road from Villers-Bocage to that hill. And he later described that this was the most difficult decision for him up until that point, because he knew he had to do something against that British tank column. But of course, he was aware of the odds of him being alone. And but he decided to go ahead. He took on the British tank column. He took out the first leading tank, a British medium tank, and that blocked the convoy from proceeding further. And then he drove along the British column and just took out one tank after the other. All in all, 21 British tanks. And he also scattered a British APC battalion that would be armored personnel carriers. For this action, he was awarded the swords to the Knight's Cross. After destroying the column, he actually drove into the village, destroyed more British tanks. No, actually, these are included in these 21, I think. But what happened then was anti-tank gun got the tracks of his Tiger tank, and so he had to abandon the tank. But as he believed it could be recovered, he did not order the destruction of the Tiger, and made his way on foot with his crew back to the nearest German outpost. And he, in his report, he described that he came across several British tanks and could have taken them out if only he had had any sort of field anti-tank weapon for infantry, but they didn't. So he had to leave them alone. And he basically, he couldn't take back the village, of course. The British were still there. But a German counterattack followed, and there was a lot of back and forth over this village. And because it was quite important strategically, the Allies did not want to leave it to the Germans, and their solution was to bomb the village to dust with 250 heavy RAF bombers, dropping 1,100 tons of bombs on this small village. So it was never, after that, held by any side, because it was simply not there anymore.
Did that take him out as well?
No, that is not where he died. But I'm going to get to that very shortly now. He was offered to become instructor at the Panzer Training School in Paderborn after the Villers-Bocage battle, the initial one. And but he refused, because it would mean to leave his comrades at the front and have a rather safe job back at home in Germany and being an instructor. But he refused. And so on the 8th of August of this year, Whitman and his group of seven Tigers were ambushed by British and Canadian tanks, which scored a direct hit on Whitman's Tiger, igniting the ammunition, and he most likely died instantly. There was actually afterwards a lot of claims about who it was that destroyed Whitman's Tiger, but it seems the most credible theory or story is that it was a British tank. But over time, even Polish tank commanders claimed to have killed him. But it was proven, I think, conclusively that there were no Polish units in the vicinity that day. He died in battle, but who is to say who was luckier? The ones that had to go into captivity and be tortured or starved to death in Germany, or those that actually died in battle and never had to witness what they did to Germany after the war?
Yeah, you could think that he was lucky in a way, and he died at his post, and he died in his beloved tank after after leading such a full life and doing so much for his country. That's some quite incredible statistics there. When you said that the 80 tanks, was that just in that one run that he took out 80 tanks, or was that the tally right from the start? Was it that just during that one battle he took out 80?
No, during that one battle it was 21 tanks.
No, not that one, but before that, the one before that, the one where he took out...
Oh, the one at the Battle of Kursk.
Yeah.
Now there he took out 30 enemy tanks and 28 anti-tank guns.
Ah, right. That's still a hell of a lot of tanks to take out and to keep going and to survive it. That's quite,
yes, that's incredible.
Quite incredible. That brings it home again. Dennis, you covered the Battle of Kursk in your documentary, didn't you? You see the snow and it really brings it home to you, the reality of the situation when you hear what was going on from inside the tanks and the individual battles. Because we sort of see the outside of it in your documentary, but we don't actually imagine what's going on in their minds and the individual battles themselves. And that must have been incredible. You think hundreds and hundreds of tanks facing one another, firing at one another. That's an incredible battle that went on. Do you know anything about where the battle was actually held? There must be lots of waste from this battle still there, I would have thought.
Yeah, was the prominent point Messerschmitt just mentioned was the fact that the Germans didn't actually lose the battle. In fact, they did kill a lot more of the Soviet tank and armies than the other way around, yet still, because of the huge manpower that the Russians had, they could quite easily survive that kind of loss. Whereas if the Germans had any significant loss, that are more than twice as hard, 3, 4, 5 times more, because the Russians could simply replace them, and the Germans didn't have that power. And the fact that America sent the billions to keep the Soviets in the war, which I also state in the documentary. I think they got to about 17 miles from the center of Moscow. Not only was that a huge amount of money keeping Stalin afloat, but then the winter came in as well. So there's a lot of things that went on. And that tank battle was just an example of the manpower that the Soviets could call on. I mean, at one point, they even threw them into battle without the rifles. They had to go and run with the people with the rifles. And if the rifle was lost, if the person was shot, the person would pick up that rifle and carry on. Otherwise, of course, the blocking unit was behind you would have killed them anyway. So a lot of history that we didn't know about at one point, and that I found fascinating when I was researching it, Michael Whitman, to me, was the typical handsome and blonde, valiant type German. You know, he personified that image. Wonderful, wonderful guy.
I think 10 to 1, the odds, 10 to 1 against them. I would say that was probably in most battles. And yet their determination and drive carried them through because they knew what they were fighting for. They knew the truth of what they were fighting against, and they didn't want to lose what they had.
No. You know,
I don't know if they still do lessons in etiquette, camaraderie at training, at army training. And that just shows you that they weren't these monsters that they're portrayed to be. Special lessons in how to be polite and etiquette. And I should imagine that that would be possibly slightly differ for the different countries that that they were involved in, that they were fighting it. And you're not going to teach the soldiers etiquette if they're just going to be killing everyone, or they're going to be raping and stealing. You're going to teach them that so that they can say, look, you know, we're not after the civilians. You know, we're just trying to liberate this country, or we just want to take this country over to secure it so that the Allies can't use it to launch attacks on us. You know, so that just shows you, yeah, doesn't it?
Plus, again, the point that Masha mentioned, again, I mentioned it in the documentary, the fact that the officers weren't the usual officer what sat on the hill and watched his men go into war. He was actually there in the middle fighting with them. And I don't think any army unit in the world has ever lost as many officers as what the SS did during World War II. And before they entered a village as well, if they were about to enter a place, they would put a shirt and tie on and make it, you know, presentable to meet these villagers they were going in to liberate, you know, in the Ukraine. So a real high-tech, you know, high-moraled army, to say the least.
I mean, it reminds me of the last one there with the Luftwaffe, when they were saying about the pilots and how it was whoever was the best pilot, regardless of rank, whoever was the best pilot, the best at his job, would lead the team. So it was the same thing there with the officers fighting in amongst their team and their platoon and taking the hits along with the fellow fighters and the camaraderie. Hitler was really big on this. I think the camaraderie that he experienced in World War One affected him a lot, and that showed him that when you're fighting against an enemy, you and it's a life or death situation, you form these bonds with people. And I think national service helped to do that. Even though you weren't fighting to your death, you knew that you were defending your country. You knew you had to. You were training to defend your country, and you knew that you had to rely on the people around you. So there was no room for if you didn't get on with somebody, say, you just have to ignore that and try to get on with them. And that would teach people, you know, how to, that would build their character up, basically. And when we got rid of national conscription, we lost all of that. And I think we can see that in the countries that still have it. Finland still has national conscription. And look at how strongly nationalistic they are, and the way that they are against the immigration. And they still have this army training. And look at Switzerland, again, national conscription, and they still have guns in their homes. So if anything goes off in Switzerland, the Swiss can still defend themselves. So I think it was wrong of us to really get rid of national conscription. Well, thank you very much for bringing that to us, Schmidt. It's fascinating to learn about these people, these heroic German men that fought in this war, because we're never going to get told about them in over here in our history lessons or in the television series or in the Hollywood movies. It's always just going to be portraying them as evil. And we were just discussing something off air that I remember from looking at the old comics. I used to look at old comic books from the 60s, the 70s, maybe even going back to the 50s. And the Germans were never portrayed as being super evil like they are today. They were never gassing Jews or turning them into lampshades and soap. They were always just portrayed as just like us, but a bit bumbling and a bit daft. You know, it would mock them, but it would never make them out to be evil. Yet today, they feel free to just slander the Germans all the time and make them out to be these really evil people. And we were saying, well, maybe that's because the people that were still alive back then are no longer alive now, so they can't speak up and say, well, hang on, this is wrong. And obviously the Jews have controlled everything so much now that the movies, Hollywood, all the propaganda, it's the truth just doesn't get a look in. So I'm really pleased that you come on here to bring the truth to us about these people, Schmidt.
My great pleasure.